The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. With Halloween ahead of us, to a show dedicated to a scientific perspective on ghosts, ghouls and everything that goes bump in the night. To help us understand why we love to scare ourselves silly at this time of year, why we obsess about werewolves, vampires and voices from the other side, I'll be joined by Professor Chris French from the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit at Goldsmiths, University of London, and Deborah Hyde, editor of The Skeptic magazine, and a writer on superstition, religion, and belief. For good measure, we also have Nicola Davis, commissioning editor for Observer Tech Monthly. If you too want to take all the fun out of Halloween by listening to scientists explain what's really going on, stay tuned. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Chris, before we get started, what on earth is anomalistic psychology?
Right, anomalistic psychology is basically the psychology of weird stuff. So it covers everything from alien abduction claims to ghosts to people who think they've got psychic powers, etc., etc. And, I mean, there's really, I suppose, kind of two strands in terms of the research we do. The main strand is trying to come up with non-paranormal, usually psychological, explanations for why people might think they've had a paranormal experience. But we also do devote a considerable amount of time to directly testing paranormal claims. So we'll test psychics, etc., and guess what? We've never found any convincing evidence that they can do what they say they can do.
And Deborah, you're not only editor of Skeptic magazine, you're an expert in werewolves and vampires, which to me sounds like a sort of teetotal expert in vodka. How did that come about?
Well, not at all, because people's persistence in weird beliefs is well, I mean, it's persistent. People have always believed in gods and angels. It's no dafter to believe in werewolves and vampires. And that says something interesting about human psychology. So it's a pretty natural way that we are, and it tells us more about human beings if we study that.
So you're both here because Halloween's nearly upon us. It's time for ghouls and ghosts and going around people's houses and getting sweets. Chris, what are the roots of the celebration? I don't know if it's pagan or Christian, but one of the strangest things to me seems that there's a decent proportion of people who genuinely believe in ghosts or similar sort of spooky entities. How common are believers in this type of thing?
Well, it varies from country to country, from era to era, but you will always find a sizable minority. I mean, it's not surprising to find opinion polls that put the figure around about 40-50% of people say they believe in ghosts. And then quite a sizable proportion of those claim they have had a direct personal encounter with a ghost. And so obviously there's a huge challenge there. If you don't believe in ghosts, it doesn't appear to be the case that all of these people are lying. Some of them are. There are deliberate hoaxes. I mean, the Amityville Horror, for example, which was a case that the book for the Amityville Horror topped the non-fiction bestseller lists for months on end, and it's now generally recognised as being a hoax from start to finish. But the vast majority of cases are made by people who sincerely believe in what they're saying.
Nicola, you've got a question already.
Well, I just wanted to ask, is there, you know, do you find certain psychological traits in people that believe these things? Are there certain sort of pointers that you find come up again and again with people who believe in ghosts and sort of vampires and all that sort of thing?
There's a huge amount of variation, but yes, there is a kind of an average profile, mm-hmm, of the typical believer. Now, that means that some people who believe in the paranormal won't fit this profile at all, but you will find that there are certain personality traits. I mean, one of the ones which kind of stands out for me is a personality trait known as fantasy proneness. People who have very, very vivid imaginations, often very, very creative individuals, but they are people whose imagination, they spend a lot of time in fantasy. What they daydream about, what they fantasize about, feels so real to them that maybe subsequently they will confuse something that really did happen with something they just imagined or dreamt about, and so on. Along with fantasy proneness, There are things like absorption, the degree to which people become totally absorbed in what they're doing. There's hypnotic susceptibility, dissociativity, the tendency to go into kind of mildly altered states of consciousness, or as my grandmother would say, being away with the fairies, you know. But those kind of people are typical of people who do report not just ghostly encounters, but also claim to have healing powers, also have a wide range of kind of New Agey type beliefs.
Now, obviously, the idea of like healing powers could be pretty detrimental to people who might see that as a sort of medical solution. That's not a great idea to go and think you're going to cure whatever's wrong with you like that. But in terms of believing in ghosts and stuff, you know, is that something that we should be, I mean, besides it being a bit of a peculiar belief, do you think it's something we should be worried about people believing in or sort of try to open their eyes? Or how do you feel about that?
I mean, the evidence suggests that people who have just lost someone, people who are going through bereavement, often if they have these kinds of experiences, I mean, and by these kinds of experiences, it might range from just a strong sense of presence that the person is still around to smelling their perfume or hearing their voice or even kind of full apparitional experiences, seeing them sitting in their favourite chair as you walk into the room and so on. People who have those kinds of experiences in a bereavement context typically see them as very positive. And actually, the evidence suggests that people cope better with bereavement if they have those kinds of experiences than if you don't. But in non-bereavement contexts, people find them very scary. I mean, I remember as a kid, I was petrified of ghosts. You know, I really was. I couldn't sleep. It scared me to death. And I think, certainly for a lot of children, and a lot of adults too, they do find the idea very, very, very scary. So that's a downside there. But I mean, I think one of the main reasons that people believe in ghosts is because one of the biggest fears that we all have is our own mortality. And also the notion that when our loved ones die, that's it, we will never see them again. So any kind of evidence for life after death, we will tend to cling to. And of course, if you believe in life after death, it opens up very easily the notion that maybe ghosts exist, maybe sometimes spirits hang around on the earthly plane for a while.
This concept of a ghost, though, goes back to this idea of dualism, the idea that you'd have a part of your consciousness as sort of non-physical, that although it can sort of talk to your body while you're alive, somehow has its own existence after life. I mean, what do neuroscientists make of all this?
Well, the vast majority of neuroscientists and the vast majority of philosophers, of, you know, people who've looked at the mind-body problem, as it's called, would see dualism as being not a very good explanation, not very plausible. It certainly doesn't fit with modern neuroscience. There are a small group of people who believe that things like possibly claims about ghosts, but certainly near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences do provide evidence for some kind of separation for mind and body. But I'd say even in those cases, there are more plausible alternative explanations in terms of it being a hallucinatory experience.
You mentioned neuroscience actually in that particular context, because in the upcoming edition of the magazine, which is coming out very soon, Dr. Jason Braithwaite, who's a neuroscientist, has written an article about exactly that subject. And just to let you know the kind of approach he takes, he calls it Occam's chainsaw. He absolutely doesn't believe that there's any kind of dualistic supporting evidence with neuroscience.
Deborah, you come from this historian's perspective, and some of these myths have incredible richness. They have enormous stories around them. And I'm wondering where they come from. Can you trace some of these stories of these different kinds of beasts back to particular times and types of incident?
I think we can tell a lot about people's habitual ways of thinking from the ways that stories take place. You've got ghosts with chains, for example, well before Marley's ghost. It sort of signified the encumbrances of a badly lived life. So we tend to come up with these same paced stories and the same themes with regard to people changing into animals, for example. It could depend on kind of what you meant by changing into a werewolf, whether you were suffering from a mental derangement or whether or not you were cursed by a demon. So it's difficult to say in each case. But one of the things that's notable about were-animals is they're always apex predators. There's no point in going to the trouble of changing into an animal and then changing into a were-hamster. Mythology seems to be certain on that one.
Did you say were-animals? So they're different things other than werewolves?
Yes, it depends what's in a person's natural biological environment as to what they will assume that a person can change into. So in African mythology, there's were-hyenas, there are were-lions, were-jaguars in South America.
Were-rabbits in Wallace and Gromit?
Well, do you know, I use that slide in my lectures because people laugh, they realise it's incongruous.
I still don't understand where the idea comes from.
They can start out as, in various cultures, you see them as totemic animals. For example, in Scandinavian culture and Viking culture, you would have people take on the identity of a bear or a wolf because they're very fierce animals, and they might wear the animal's skins, and the idea is that the people are kin with those animals. You know, again, you don't want to be kin with a hamster, you want to be kin with something that's fierce and strong in the environment. But in specifically in the great witch hunts in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, it was believed that people sometimes literally did change into wolves in order to perform demonic acts. And there was a great deal of ink wasted on the exact mechanism of how this happened. And it was interesting because it shows the kind of scholastic thinking, the kind of philosophy that the church was using prior to empiricism. They were really trying to work out how somebody could appear that they had changed into a wolf. One theory was that Satan changed the air around a person so that it appeared to other people that they were a wolf, because a person's brain was too big and needed, threw out too much heat to be confined into a little skull. So there was a great deal of attention paid to the actual mechanisms of this, and a lot of rubbish spoken, but people really did try to work out causal mechanisms.
You used the word literally there. I mean, who was it who saw this as real?
During the witch hunts, both Catholics and Protestants used to accuse each other of all sorts of demonic acts. It was just a way of being abusive. So the theologists would accuse people of changing sometimes witches into hares. The Dominicans specifically persecuted the Inquisition, and they would go for people in small isolated hamlets where they would have natural biological wolves in their environment, and people would whip themselves up into a frenzy, and they would think that somebody had changed into a wolf. Quite often these people were actually outsiders or disliked or poor or something like that.
And I presume that scapegoating was quite a big factor in all of this.
Absolutely massive factor, yeah. In fact, specifically with vampires, actually, when you get an environment where something uncertain is happening, where there's an epidemic death, it doesn't have to be death from one congruent disease, it could just be a spate of deaths from different causes, then you get people seeming to want the power to do something, to identify something and to do something. So if they can identify a corpse, it's actually more merciful than identifying a living person and torturing while they're alive.
Nicola.
I was going to ask, we were talking there about vampires, so presumably that stems from a rather different sort of historical narrative. Can you tell us a bit about where vampires come from?
The modern perspective on vampires, it's thought that it's two things. As Chris said, it's a kind of a scapegoating mechanism in the context of people being panicky because there's been epidemic death. And the second thing is their misunderstanding about the normal processes of decomposition. And it's very easy for us to be all pompous and say, well, of course, this happens and that happens. But we can observe these things in a safe context. And in historical times, you would bury a body very, very quickly for the simple reason that it was a source of contagion. So the fact that, for example, rigor mortis wears off and a body becomes flexible again, or that not all bodies decompose at the same rate, or that the viscera can appear to be fresh even after a while in the grave, would all mislead people into thinking that there was some more life left in the body where it wasn't.
What role did the media have in all of this? And was it just a sort of Victorian thing with penny dreadfuls, whatever?
No, not at all. The vampire epidemic, as it was called at the time, in fact, probably was a result of Slavic folklore originating in kind of like the 9th or 10th centuries. It's very, very primal folklore. But it suddenly hit the West after the Ottoman Empire receded. So we had a Western government looking after administering people who were previously under a different government. And these lurid stories that the governments misunderstood, or the doctors on the site misunderstood, were incredibly popular pamphlets and paperbacks. And that's how the story got out. People loved this stuff.
How do they distribute this stuff?
There were book fairs. The Leipzig Book Fair of, I think it was, 1732, had a best-selling pamphlet about a vampire. People just absorbed it.
Because it's incredible how these stories endure, that they're still in the TV ratings. You can still buy, there's still loads of movies around this kind of idea. Anyway.
Why is it that even though the majority, and we hope the majority of people don't actually believe that there are vampires and werewolves, what is it about these stories that are so compelling that even those of us who think it's all nonsense still have that kind of, you know, the Harry Potter effect, the wanting to hear about, the wanting to be scared. What is it about these stories?
Well, I'm sure Deborah's got things to say on this, but I mean, from my point of view, I didn't really pay very much attention to things like belief in vampires and so on in terms of anomalistic psychology, because my attitude was, well, that's just stories. People don't actually really believe in that. But then you realise, I mean, listening to Deborah give talks and so on, that actually at certain points in history, lots and lots of people genuinely believed in this as a reality. That was their belief system. And then it's important to ask the questions, well, what kind of functions did those beliefs serve? Where did they originate from and so on? And there's an important distinction to be made between the kind of literary vampire, and again, I know this is something that Deborah's got a lot to say on, and the folkloric vampire. So whereas the folkloric vampire was not at all sexy like the vampires that we get today, they were very, very ugly, but very libidinous for all that. You know, that there was this kind of divergence which came about when people started writing stories about it. Now, I don't have a problem with any form of the paranormal in fiction, because it makes great stories. It's good enough for Dickens, good enough for Shakespeare, good enough for me, you know.
I think it's interesting you mentioned about the vampires being sometimes libidinous as well, despite not being attractive, because one of Chris's areas that I think one of the first talks I ever saw you doing was about sleep paralysis, which is like a little minor sleep disorder. You can get libidinous feelings with that as well, and it feels like an assault, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've spoken about sleep paralysis in these podcasts before, but essentially, it's in its most basic form, it's very, very common. About 40% of our first year intake typically report they've experienced it at least once. Half awake, half asleep, and you realise you can't move, and it lasts for a few seconds and you snap out of it. But you can, about one person in 20 reports more vivid experiences where you can have hallucinatory experiences, you can see weird stuff, including kind of monstrous figures and so on. You feel pressure on the chest, there's difficulty breathing, you might hear voices, footsteps, etc. It can be absolutely terrifying. And so, I mean, with a lot of these kind of phenomena, there's no kind of one-size-fits-all type explanation. There are lots of mutually reinforcing things. So, you know, what Deborah says about the origins of vampires, that would be reinforced when people had sleep paralysis episodes, and in that kind of context, that would be interpreted as being a possible attack by a vampire or a demon or whatever else it may be.
Chris, what exactly is sleep paralysis, though?
Well, again, in broad terms, we do understand what it is. And just to reassure any listeners out there who have had episodes and not know what's going on, and either feel that maybe it was a real paranormal event, or maybe they're losing their mind, they're going crazy, it's neither of those things. What actually happens during the normal sleep cycle, you go through different stages, stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, all kinds of changes take place in breathing rate, brain waves, other psychophysiological measures, you come back up through those phases and you go into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And that's the stage of sleep that is typically associated with vivid dreams. And the assumption is that, I mean, what actually happens during REM sleep is that the muscles of your body are actually paralysed, presumably to stop you acting out the actions of the dream. But with these sleep paralysis episodes, something's gone a little bit awry, and it's as though your mind's woken up, but your body hasn't. So you can see that you're in your bedroom, you can see your surroundings, you can't move, and there's all this weird dream imagery coming through into consciousness. So it's this kind of weird mix between normal waking consciousness and dream consciousness. And the result, as I say, can be absolutely terrifying.
Why would people have scary visions in that instance, rather than some jolly thing, a big puppy, or maybe that'd be scary as well, but I don't know, something else at the end of the bed?
Well, I think it's interesting, actually, because I think that there's a neglected kind of area of research here, insofar as it's almost the flip side of what we find with near-death experiences. With near-death experiences, the original research all seemed to suggest it was an incredibly positive, blissful experience. And then one or two researchers began to say, you know what, it isn't always. Sometimes there are these negative near-death experiences. And I think it's the other way around with sleep paralysis. I mean, I confess I'm probably guilty of kind of generally presenting sleep paralysis as being this horrible, scary experience, which it usually is. But you also do find people who occasionally report blissful experiences. And I think a lot of reports of angelic encounters, for example, are probably sleep paralysis episodes just with a different emotional tone. Now, in terms of explaining in detail why that would sometimes happen, we're not really at that stage of knowledge, but in terms of why they're usually perceived as negative and threatening, I mean, one possibility is that, I mean, during REM sleep, the amygdala, the part of the brain that deals with threat and danger and generates fear responses, is highly activated. So it may well be that you are in this kind of highly aroused, fearful state, but as there's nothing actually out there in objective reality to explain it, the mind kind of constructs this thing that would account for why you are feeling like that. Again, it's interesting looking at different cross-cultural accounts of the same core experience, but you get this kind of cultural overlay. You know, you might find people literally experiencing seeing demons or whatever.
Well, in a modern context as well, they do. One of the big things you should do if you suffer from sleep paralysis a lot is don't sleep on your back, because it overwhelmingly happens while you're lying on your back. Don't sleep at funny times of the day, because it happens when you crash into REM sleep, so don't take naps in the afternoon. But the third thing is learn to moderate your fear response, because it's self-begetting. If you're fearful when it happens, it builds up and up and up and can make it worse and can make it happen again. And this is why it bothers me so profoundly that there are some evangelical churches who provide services for relief from sexual demons. So they're actually confirming the belief in a modern context of assault by sexual demons. And this information, I mean, I've written to some of them, this information is out here, that it's harmless and that you can overcome it with some very boring, ordinary measures. But given that it gets worse with fear, I don't think it can help if people truly believe they're being assaulted by demons.
So we've been talking a bit about sort of historical myths and where they've come from, but there are myths that have cropped up in more recent times, you know, UFOs being one of them that seems to have taken to the stage. Where does that come from? And are there things that are sort of emerging now, new myths that are sort of evolving even now in our 21st century?
Well, just on the alien abduction thing, I mean, sleep paralysis seems to be a very core component there as well. You know, you might initially think, well, okay, I can see that sleep paralysis episodes are scary, but they don't typically kind of involve 4-foot-high grey aliens with big black eyes. So how do people end up with these detailed memories of being taken on board alien spaceships and having probes put in interesting places? The explanation there is, in lots of cases, and again, there's no one-size-fits-all for all the cases, but in lots of cases, people who are repeatedly having these episodes, and it might kind of say, often say, obviously, it sounds quite comical to some people that you might then come across a book that says, well, if this is happening to you, you've probably been abducted by aliens and they have wiped your memory for the rest of the experience. But actually, if you're desperate and that's the first time you've found anything written on it, it gives you an explanation, it reassures you that you're not going crazy, and then the task becomes, well, you must recover those memories. And how do you do that? You go for hypnotic regression. And again, hypnotic regression, contrary to popular belief, is not this magical key for unlocking hidden or repressed memories. It provides a fantastic context for the formation of false memories. And so you get a situation where if you go for a hypnotic regression session expecting that you may have been abducted by aliens, well, that's what you're going to get. That's what you'll remember. And you'll get very clear, detailed images to go with that, and you'll be convinced that you've unearthed a genuine memory of something that really happened. I mean, I think this is really important because the same techniques are used, whether we're talking about these bizarre claims of alien abduction, whether we're talking about claims of satanic ritual abuse, whether we're talking about past life memories, whether we're talking about, scare quotes, ordinary childhood sexual abuse, that's the same techniques. So if we're being very dubious about the claims in one area, we ought to apply the same kind of logic in all areas. And it's a real worry that a lot of, you know, being serious, that a lot of the time when claims are made of recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse, we are, I would say, almost certainly dealing with false memories.
Chris, one of the interesting things I find about this is that the people will genuinely believe that particular things have happened to them, or they'll believe stories that they've heard from sort of trusted others. What other explanations have scientists come up with? You've talked about Amityville being a hoax. You've talked about sleep paralysis. But there are other things that can be going on that may be explaining small portions of these things.
Yeah. Apart from the small minority of hoaxes, the vast majority of claims of ghosts, specifically ghostly encounters, are probably down to sincere misinterpretations of naturally occurring events. And you look at the kind of literature on this, and there's some very, very obscure explanations for things that most people would never come up with. You know, you might hear some strange noise and it turns out to be beetles ticking in the woodwork, or, you know, there are rats in the loft, or there's, you know, all kinds of possibilities. And just because people can't think of an explanation doesn't mean there isn't one. But once you've got the idea that your house is haunted, then even very mundane, ordinary things like you can't find your keys, the ghosts moved them. No, you've just forgotten where you put them. You know, that's all it is. And as I say, you also get these kind of anomalous psychological experiences. I mean, sleep paralysis can be quite extreme, but just even things like a sense of presence. We all have that feeling sometimes that someone behind us, or, you know, you find that context is really important. If people walk around a building that they are told has there'd been paranormal activity there, they'll report more of those experiences, even if it's just, it's not true. You know, the mere suggestion is enough for people to start noticing changes in temperature or even imagining those things. So all those kind of factors come in as well. I mean, our own research into kind of paranormal belief more generally does suggest that people who believe in the paranormal, report paranormal experiences, tend to show greater susceptibility to false memories. So some of the reports might actually be things that never really happened at all. They are false memories. So there's all kinds of different lines of attack on this. Hallucinatory experiences. Hallucinations are much more common in the non-clinical population than is generally appreciated. And again, you know, we all could have hallucinations under appropriate conditions.
You talk also about absorption, and you mentioned this earlier, when you're very fixed on something. And I was interested in how that might feed into this. And one example you give in one of your lectures is the famous missing gorilla in our midst example, where you have the guys passing a basketball around and then all of a sudden a guy in a gorilla suit comes along, beats his chest and walks off. And if you're trying to count the number of passes, you don't see the gorilla, or a lot of people don't see the gorilla, and I certainly didn't when I did that test. How can being so absorbed in something actually feed into this, though? Because that to me would almost be rejecting all other curious stimuli that your brain might be sort of trying to put a meaning on.
Well, the way that could work is that, I mean, I'm very often faced with people who kind of, you know, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants skeptic, how do you explain this then? And then they'll give me their own personal experience of what happened to them. Now, it's not always the case, but very often in those cases, if there was just something around in the environment at the time that they hadn't noticed, there was maybe another person in the room who moved that book that appeared to move on its own. Oh, no, I would have seen that. You think, well, would you? You know, our intuition tells us that if we're watching a scene where someone in a gorilla suit is very clearly, obviously visible, you'd see it. But no, people don't. And I mean, we've just published a paper where we've actually looked at this directly. We've compared people who show the phenomenon is called inattentional blindness. It's where you're engaged in one task and you don't see something that's there in full view. You just don't register it. And we've published a paper with a couple of experiments that showed that people who believe in the paranormal tend to be more susceptible to inattentional blindness, which kind of figures because, as I mentioned before, one of the personality factors that correlates is this thing called absorption. Absorption is this thing where you just focus on what you're doing and cut everything else off. So it does make sense. But we have this kind of, on the one hand, we've got cognitive, I mean, our cognitive systems are great. I'm really not running them down. They're fantastic. But we have an exaggerated idea of how good they are. We think we'd take in everything. We think we're taking in everything now, but actually the visual system actually filters things to a very high degree, and a lot of the time the mind is kind of filling in the blanks. Perception and memory are constructive processes, and therefore they're prone to error.
Human beings are also prone to finding meaning in things. It's what Deborah Kellerman calls the teleological-based explanation. We want to find meanings, we want to create narratives, and we can do so even where they're not there. So if you ask a child to come up with a story about a polar bear in a white coat, he will come up with a why-based explanation instead of a how-based explanation. And coming up with a how-based explanation needs a lot of training. You've got to be educated into that. She noted that some uneducated Eastern European people, Roma people, also favoured those kind of meaning-based explanations. So she inferred from that it was a natural human way of thinking. So something will happen, we'll pick out the bits that we want, then we'll create a narrative, and that narrative will be based on the fact that there is something in the environment, whether you can directly perceive it or not, that has intention.
And that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective as well. I mean, why have we got these biases? We've got them because in general terms, We think in terms of quick and dirty heuristics that usually give us the right answer. It makes sense, if you think about it, for us to assume that there is something that might be a potential threat that's just caused that noise that we've heard, rather than just ignore it or to think, I mean, probabilistically, it probably isn't really a threat, you know, but there's the cost-benefit analysis that comes in here. So we've got this bias towards intentionality, as Deborah says, and we tend to assume, our default is to assume that when something happens, someone or something made it happen for a reason. Therefore, it's a potential threat.
Because it doesn't matter how many faces we see in slices of burnt toast, but you only get to ignore a tiger once. So...
Chris, you must be the only person I know who's tried to create a haunted room. How did you go about doing that, and why did you do it?
Okay, well, one of the interesting ideas that just kind of knocking around in the research literature is the possibility that some of these experiences, some of these ghostly encounters, might be explained as hallucinatory experiences, but that are caused by environmental factors. Now, I mean, I think there's no doubt at all that some environmental factors will have that effect. If you go from bright illumination to dark illumination, if you go into a room with very high ceilings, and again, all that makes sense in evolutionary terms. Those were more dangerous areas if you didn't, you know, you might be attacked from somewhere. But there's other more kind of esoteric type explanations. So one, for example, an idea that's been pushed by a neuroscientist called Michael Persinger is that complex patterns of electromagnetic activity can have a direct effect on the temporal lobes of the brain in susceptible individuals and cause them to have hallucinatory experiences. And a similar idea was put around a while back about infrasound. This is sound energy that's just below the audible frequency range, typically about 19 hertz, and that can also allegedly cause people to have these hallucinatory experiences. Now, we thought these were interesting ideas. We weren't convinced that there was anything in them. We thought, well, if there is anything in them, wouldn't it be neat to build an artificial haunted room where you get people to have these weird experiences just by playing around with electromagnetic fields and infrasound? And to cut a long story short, that's what we did. So we got people to go into this room. You can't consciously tell whether you're in the presence of complex electromagnetic fields or infrasound. So we had to, obviously, for ethical reasons, it was all perfectly safe, but we had to say to people, we're going to put you into this environment where you might be exposed to complex electromagnetic fields, you might be exposed to infrasound, you might be exposed to both, you might be exposed to neither. We just want you to go in there, spend 50 minutes. We built a kind of circular, featureless chamber. Spend 50 minutes in there and tell us whether you do have any weird experiences. Quite a surprising percentage of people did, including things like sense of presence, even terror, which we hadn't really anticipated, feeling dizzy, blah, blah, blah. All these kinds of things that are typically associated with haunted locations. When we analysed our data, didn't matter what condition they were in. What it did correlate with was a measure of what Persinger refers to. We use a scale that he uses called the temporal lobe signs inventory, and he uses it to identify people who have particularly labile temporal lobes, but it's also known to correlate with suggestibility. So the most parsimonious explanation is if you say to suggestible people, go in here and you might have some weird experiences, some of them do.
And they've got 50 minutes to come up with these things and not much else to do by
Absolutely.
The sounds of things. So it's probably not very surprising. Yeah. I was just interested a little bit, and I know, Nicola, you're a big fan of methods. How are you doing the infrasound and the electromagnetic radiation?
Well, we had basically, for the electromagnetic radiation, we had a couple of coils. We had a circular chamber, and on the other side, so they weren't in full view, in one area there were these kind of, there were coils, and we also had speakers pumping out the infrasound in for the appropriate condition. As I say, in fact, didn't make any difference. I don't think it rules out the possibility that there might be something in this idea, but certainly our results didn't actually provide any support.
I suppose I have to ask, one of us is going to have to, but have you ever come across anything which you genuinely haven't been able to explain? I mean, it's got to be asked. It's the Halloween special. Let's go for it.
Okay. No. There are one or two things that I've come across over the years that I've got a mental box with a kind of just a question mark on the top. You know, that was interesting. I mean, literally, it is just a couple out of all the dozens and dozens and dozens of different types of claims that I've looked into. But particularly a couple have arisen during kind of doing TV documentaries. One was on an alleged case of reincarnation. A little boy from Glasgow called Cameron, very nice little boy, and he basically, from the moment he could speak, was reporting these apparent past life memories. In my general explanation for these things are that they're kind of false memories that have arisen for various reasons. But Cameron was interesting. His mum was not a great New Age believer who really had push this on him. She just thought this was a bit weird and wanted an explanation. My role in the programme was I just kind of basically met the mother. We kind of had a chat about possible non-paranormal explanations. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet Cameron, but they did in the programme take Cameron back to this island which he claimed he'd lived on in the past life, trying to find the house he'd said he'd lived in and so on and so forth. They initially couldn't find anything, but then they did find a house that matched. It was interesting because the programme, I think, was very fair. Where the evidence seemed to suggest there might be something in it, it talked about it. Where there were claims that just clearly weren't supported. So, for example, he claimed that in his past life his father had died in a car accident. It's a very small island. There would have been a record of it. There wasn't. So you're just left thinking, well, that was weird. I don't know what was going on there. You know, and I think it's okay to say sometimes you don't know. Just admit it.
I think what this tells us, though, is that even if we don't see any evidence for any of these things, what it does tell us is something about ourselves and what's going on in our own heads and what we love and fear, I suppose.
Well, that's absolutely it. I mean, I think for a long, 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 long time, and even when I started getting interested in this stuff, I can still remember that there were various colleagues who had a kind of a snooty attitude of, why are you interested in this rubbish? You know, we all know it's nonsense. Why are you wasting your time on it? And I think that's just such a... Well, it's not a very scientific attitude. For one thing, just because... If I had to bet my house, I'd bet my house that paranormal forces don't exist. But I might be wrong, and so we should be open to that possibility, however low the chances are. Trying to be as open-minded as you can, given all our human biases. But the second thing is that it's undeniable that the majority of the population do believe in at least one paranormal phenomenon, and a lot of people claim they've directly experienced it. So if science as a whole is right to reject these kind of claims, it's telling us something really interesting about human psychology, as you say. So either way, we win out by taking these claims seriously and trying to get the bottom of them.
I think we also have this peculiar bias of judging the difference between low and high magic. And some kinds of magic are incredibly respectable, you know, like the Pope's kind of magic, for example. And some are really stupid and not deserving of our attention, like belief in fairies. But if you look at the history of science and the history of magic and how we ended up, alchemy became chemistry, astrology became astronomy. Really, we've got so much more out of low magic, which is based on the experimental procedures, than we ever have out of religion, which is based on already starting with everything you know.
The letters will come in. Deborah Hyde and Chris French, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
really
you
appreciate
for
it.
Asking us.
A huge thanks there to Chris French and Deborah Hyde. We'll have links for Chris and Deborah's work on the blog for this podcast. Also, a big thanks to Nicola Davis. Remember to read her writing on all things scientific, technical and dog-related. Yep, dog-related. Just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and our producers this week, Jason Phipps and Ian Chambers, thanks for listening. And have a great Halloween, if we haven't ruined it for you. Bye-bye.